Hello, TSF family. We wanted to start off by saying thank you. Thank you for listening to this podcast and for your hard work to love yourself more and for your feedback.
Can you believe it's been 3 years that we've been doing this spiritual fix, and it has been such a beautiful labor of love for Anna and me.
We have loved doing this work. We've loved hearing from you, and we love exploring ourselves and each other alongside our listeners.
We wanted to put out the call for 3 ways that you can help support us to support you.
One, we would love you to leave us a review on iTunes or follow us on Spotify.
2, drop us an email and let us know how much the podcast means to you.
And 3, you can donate monthly or even just once to our PayPal patronage.
Every little bit helps, and we are so grateful to those of you who have donated already. Thank you.
You help make this podcast possible.
Thanks, y'all.
You can go to our website, www.thisspiritualfix.com, for information on how to pledge as well as to email us. Hello, TSF family, and welcome to episode 16 of season 7 of This Spiritual Fix. Today we are talking about how to communicate with your inner villains or villains and others. Enjoy.
Hypnosis. Mindfulness. Meditation.
Mama.
Past life regression.
Mommy,
RPG.
This spiritual fix. Two mystical mamas hacking the self-help game.
With Anna Stromquist
and Christina Wiltsey.
Hey, Christina.
Hi, Anna. How are you?
I'm so happy to be back on the podcast.
Back on the
podcast. Not that I was ever off it. I just mean I'm glad to be recording again. And I'm glad to have some really great information today for our listeners who are going to get to start to, not get to, but like start to really put this villain work into practical use for those of people who aren't so great at, for the people who aren't as good as like implementing this work. It's a little too like etheric, or I don't know how to explain it.
It's hard. Okay. So I, this is the way that I would describe it. So I have a friend of mine who is exceptionally somatic based in their healing, right? Like they feel something in their body and it's there and they're like, I'm going to figure this out by moving it around my body and how I feel it. Right. And there's a hope that the structure of the inner villains will have schisms that basically is like a somatic schism. And then like a, you know, therapeutic theater schism. And there's all these people who I'm like kind of working to collaborate with who could possibly take kind of almost like franchises of the villain system and put it into their specific type of practice. But there are people who struggle with narrative shadow work as a concept, right? Which is like, wait, you're talking to me about some story and how does that story actually apply to my life? Like I need something that's more grounded and like, this is what I can immediately do with these things. It doesn't matter if I'm like, oh, I'm the knight on the horse. And what does that even mean in real life when you're actually having a conversation, you're actually in the middle of it. So this is what you, I feel like have always excelled at amongst many things, Anna, in the podcast is like grounding these like far off etheric narrative things that I talk about into reality.
Well, that's my whole career as a physical therapist is trying to take what is not working and make it functional, right? Function, like implement it in your life. So I think it's just a habit from work.
And it's brilliant too, because it's like, we were just talking before we started recording about meal planning and how I've actually started meal planning. And I'm like, yes, it is as groundbreaking and revolutionary as you said it was, Anna. I should have listened to you all along. But sometimes it takes a moment for those.
That's okay. When you told me your monthly grocery bill, I was like, dear God. But I'm like, all right, I've put it out there. I've shared my ideas with you. I'll just wait. I'm sure it was less frustrating for me than it was for you to see me be a righteous bully.
I feel like you weren't very righteous bully. I feel like you did. I feel like you did the
thing. No, not about that, but just like in life in general, yeah. Like you just in general were waiting for me to have that epiphany.
It's one of those things where, I mean, it's just like with everything, it's actually, it is very, the reason I joke about righteous bully is because like, you know, if you know that you have an opinion and that opinion may be very, very well informed about something that can help fix a person, so to speak, or that they can, if they just implement it in their life, it's better. And having to sit in the place of patience where you're just like waiting for that person to come to the realization of what you've already told them. Like, I feel like so many of our relationships are just like holding space, waiting for somebody to meet a solution, whether it's a hybrid of something you've told them and something else, but you know what, to like coalesce the inputs that are coming from either people or guidance or whatever and actually implement them. And it's like, we recognize that like 95% of our time is just waiting for those moments and only 5% is like actual execution. You know what I'm trying to say? It's like, you're kind of like holding space and patience for somebody else to shift and you're not forcing them to change. You're not like stuffing it down their throat being like, you must meal plan, right? Like, this is not a thing.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying? Do you know what I'm saying? Like this whole idea of like, we wish that we could fix everybody, but it's like such a beautiful life waiting for people to fix themselves. Like, and not fix is not the right word, but like for people to love themselves in deeper ways, even if it's through something like meal planning.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it kind of reminds me, like I'm taking this Kabbalah class with my husband and it's really interesting because the main topic the last few weeks has been, what's the difference between finding meaning in your life and finding purpose in your life? Mm. And one of the things is saying how meaning is something that changes, and meaning is the value and the interpretation that we put on our lives, right? But actually, your purpose in life is unchanging, and your purpose in life is not coming from within. It's coming from outside of you. Okay. And it's something, because like, for example, the example he gave was like, let's say you buy an iPhone 16 and you decide to put it in the doorway because it makes the perfect door jam. Like, that is not what it was created to do, right? Like the other example he gave was like, let's say you get a Picasso and you're like, this is perfect. It's just the right size for me to cut my vegetables on. And you cut your vegetables on this Picasso and you cut holes in it. Again, that was not the purpose for which the creator intended it, right? And so meaning is the value and the interpretation we put on our lives. And purpose is what we have been created to do. Yes. And we ourselves are blind to our own purpose. And so it's other people and other life events that show us what our purpose is. So like, going in a roundabout way is like, sometimes it's so easy for us on the outside looking at our friends and our loved ones to know like what is purposeful. I'm not making any sense. I'm going to delete all this.
No. Okay. Can I try and ground
but
it?
But what I'm trying to say, yeah, what I'm just trying to say is sometimes it's so easy to see everything and everyone else because
you can't see the label from inside the jar. I think that that's like a really part that you can say with this, right? Is that like, it's hard to see your own purpose. And it's kind of like what you were talking about last episode about how, like, you know, Buckminster Fuller talked about the law of precession and how purpose comes 90 degrees off of wherever you're headed, right? It's like, there's this recognition of the fact that like, you're not in charge of your purpose, which is why when people talk about purpose-driven lives, I'm just like, I wish that there was kind of something else that we could kind of replace that with. That was like a very catchy phrase, you know, because I've been reading Man's Search for Meaning, right? So Viktor Frankl's book. And, you know, he talks about the concentration camps and how he got through those through the process of being an observer and being in an observer state as a result of that, right? And that in many ways, like when he was going to write the book anonymously, and he chose to not do it anonymously, which then basically set forth this entire chain of events in which, you know, his entire life changed, but he never had the intention of writing it for success, right? That's the money and the honey sort of thing. This idea of like, he just wrote it because he felt he needed to write it. And it was kind of how it was him talking about his experience of like how he got through all of these awful experiences and how he was able to keep an observer perspective, which is, you know, one of the things coupled with a number of different things that he talks about that kept him alive. And, you know, he's very honest and frank about, you know, the mental states that he was in during those different times. And like, it just strikes me that he says, like, you, in many ways, you're not in charge of what happens with something when you create it. And the more that you're empty about it, the better off, you know, you're going to be, because then you're releasing it to become whatever it wants to become. And it's the same with a person. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does. But I think we're contradicting each other.
Are we? Okay, explain how we're contradicting each other.
Because from what I, well, at least from what I'm learning, is that the creator knows what your purpose is. Mm-hmm. You don't define your purpose. So by him creating the book and then saying, let it just be whatever it needs to be, then the book defines its purpose.
But the book is an act of creation from God.
Oh, it's not his creation. I see. I see. Okay. Yes. Then totally makes sense. Right. Totally makes sense.
Yeah. If we see that we are acts of creation from the universe or God or whatever it is, that the acts, the things that we choose to create because our soul or spirit or whatever, our inkling of whatever decides to do it, that is the universe acting through us. And the more you treat it as not your responsibility, the better. So yeah.
I love it. I want you to tell us all about the dream you had that was like this huge epiphany, extremely deep epiphany about the villains.
It was. And the thing is that I've often thought about this because, you know, I think that the world organizes itself in many different ways. Three is like the Trinity or triplicity. A lot of things in this world represent three. Six, so 666, perfect imperfection. That's like obviously comes from a lot of Christian mysticism, as well as other things along those lines that call it like the sign of the devil. Six is an aspect of shadow that exists. Nine is an extension of this, right? So it's like you see things collecting themselves in 3, 6, and 9. And so the villain system is obviously a system of nine. And one of the things that I've thought about a lot, and the reason why the Enneagram is useful, is because the Enneagram goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Right. So it's like oftentimes my shorthand of talking about the villains is not through its theme, for instance, belonging, or even through its pinnacle villain, for instance, obedient critic. It's through saying, oh, the 1, the 2, the 3, the 4, the 5. And I've always wondered if that means that you're supposed to do them in order. Right. If there's any sort of order to the fact that it follows a numerical system of 1 through 9. And the other day I had a dream. I have no idea where I went in this space. It was in a liminal space before I got up. And they told me the story, and they told it to me through the experience of the life cycle of a flowering plant, because both Anna and I know and understand that life cycle very well, having both been gardeners. And so I'm just going to tell this brief story of what it means to recognize that we are all on a path. We are all effectively walking flowers in many ways. We produce, reproduce sexually. We have these periods of fertility, right? When we like flower, and then we have these periods of creating seeds, and whether those seeds are actual children or whether they are books, like we were talking about, like whether whatever are creation, acts of creation. And then we all have periods of kind of dormancy and retirement, so to speak. And so if we look at the inner villains as a process of recognizing that there will be some times when we feel arrested in a certain area, but we go through every single phase, and sometimes we're in our villainous form, sometimes we're in our legendary form, this is where we go. So the obedient critic is the equivalent of a seed. We talk about at the very beginning of the podcast about Goenkaji, and how Goenkaji talks about how you can never make like a lemon tree a mango tree. Like you can never change the nature of a lemon. And the obedient critic struggles a lot with what they've inherited as the rules in which they're supposed to be governed in this world. And there are a set of rules, but the more universal you become with those rules, the more you become the legend, right? So in the sense of knowing that a seed, as a person, as a seed, has a set of instructions, and those instructions can be extremely limiting and extremely self-hating or self-sabotaging, especially if you feel like you don't belong to those set of rules. And it being able to move through that makes it so that you can come out of a seed. The vengeful martyr, for people who've ever grown seedlings, you will know that there is a stage when you plant a seed, you get it warm and wet enough, and then all of a sudden you have this like initial burst of energy, and you get what are called the cotyledon, which are basically the initial leaves. They're the new leaves, like the baby leaves. They're kind of like baby teeth in some ways. And all of that energy comes from within the seed. And that is the expression of the vengeful martyr. The vengeful martyr is the expression of a seed that is able to get power from its own energy. And it's not dependent on anything else. It has a catalyst, which that catalyst is heat and wet. And after that, it's growing on your own. So for people who are stuck in the vengeful martyr arc, they will find that they have to do everything on their own energy. Like, they don't have any helpful people. They don't have anything else. Like, everything runs because of them, right? So that's the human equivalent of this seed phase. Does that make sense? All right. So the vein controller, there's a place, if you've ever grown a seedling, you'll be like, look, the seedlings came up so fast. And then they struggle because you need to water them and they need to establish channels for which resources can come into them. They have to develop their first true leaves, which is the leaves that you will recognize as the adult plant leaves. They have to develop roots. That is the stage of the vein controller. The vein controller is learning how to create channels for resources to come in and out, right? So that's the stage of the vein controller. So if you are a human and you are stuck in the vein controller, you can struggle with wanting to put out your feelers and wanting to put out your channels and actually rely on outside people in order to be able to grow and know that you can't hoard your resources. You have to basically let yourself be vulnerable and trust that the world is going to provide for you. Or not. The stage four, which is the eternal child, is all about growth. For people who are eternal children, you will notice that they have every single resource ever at their command. If people are stuck in the eternal child and they haven't kind of worked on the channels, stable channels of resources, they can do something like, I heard a story the other day where there was a person who kept having companies run into their car and kept getting these massive, huge payouts from the companies, insurance companies, right? Like $250,000 payouts. Like, they were fine. They weren't injured or anything along those lines. And so basically their car had to get a couple of dents and all of a sudden they had these like massive payouts as a result of it. Like, an eternal child person can have lots of resources that way, but it's kind of chaotic. It's like, hey, yeah, get in an accident and you have to deal with your nervous system now as a result of getting an accident, but great, you have abundance, right? You can see how that kind of looks a little bit different. There's a lot of growth. It can be good and it can be bad, and it is very abundant. Then you have the evasive expert, the five stage of growth, which is balancing inputs. So for anybody who's grown a plant, there comes a point when you recognize that you need to like allow the plant to be, you know, the assumption is that the plant is in the ground. It is doing everything that it needs to do, but is it getting enough water? Is it getting enough sun? Like, are you actually balancing the inputs correctly to be able to allow that plant to thrive into its next stage beyond just that initial burst of seed growth and that initial burst of true growth leaves? Does this make sense? Yep. All right. So the next stage is the divisive immortal stage, which is the idea of, it's all about the death that you will have to face by flowering into your potential. You are having to go out into the community and get different genetic sources, right? So you literally have to flower and you have to like be okay with like the kind of the inevitable death that will happen when you choose to kind of reproduce with the world, when you choose to mix and match with everybody that in everything that's there. And if you're stuck in this phase as a human, then you're going to experience this desire to just want to stay in your own space and never go out. Or you're going to want to stay in a community that's very isolated, that doesn't allow genetic diversity, so to speak. Like, I mean, you know what I'm talking about? Like, that just allows like-minded people, only you, like you're only one thinking of it, like that kind of thing. That's what I mean by genetic diversity. I'm using the flowering analogy here. The hunger shapeshifter, like literally the picture looks like a whole bunch of seeds. The hungry shapeshifter is, once you've pollinated and move past the divisive immortal stage, you go to the hungry shapeshifter, which is all about creating seeds that are the potentials for everything that you want to create in the world. People who are in the hungry shapeshifter arc are often exceptionally creative, and they are creating little children all over the place, meaning like they could be actual children, they could be books, they could be movies, they could be, you know, projects, they could be inventions, they could be all sorts of different things. And then the righteous bully is the stage in which you have to allow the seeds to be released into the environment. It's kind of like a motherly phase, right? Where you're like letting it go, you're letting the seeds go, knowing that you're not in charge of what happens to those seeds ultimately. You may be a nurse plant, you may be a plant that wants the seeds to drop really close by so that you can watch them grow, but a lot of them are gonna go on the wind and you're not gonna know where they are. Your job is not to fix them, your job is not to do anything, your job is to stay kind of in this state of like, I know that the source of who I am as a person is going to go forward into this world. And that's how I protect until I am no longer in charge of protecting. And it's not my job to fix my children once I release them. And then the last stage is the stage that happens after the seed is released and the plant starts to desiccate. And it's the crone phase, right? It's like the phase of retirement, of just like being there to surrender back to the soil and to be recycled at the end of the year.
What does the symbolism do to help us if we're on this villain journey? Like, so, we should be going in order?
Okay, so there's one thing which says going in order, which I've been trying recently, and the jury's still out on that one. There is something to be said for it. I think the main thing to look at is, if you look at it from this perspective and you recognize that you resonate with a villain, say that you're like, I recognize that I resonate with a vain controller. You can be like, what does that mean? That means that I need to work on my external resources and my channeling, because I am trying to create those first new leaves, right? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, you can recognize that, like, if you're out of order, if you're working on the nothing and you still have to work on the one that comes earlier, you know, which is the 5 and the 6 come before the 9, then you can do that as work as well. And so it's kind of meant to be an analogy. And for me, in a narrative framework, it actually works really well for being able to identify where people are. So I thought I'd offer it.
Nice.
Yeah. So tell me, Anna, about communication.
Okay. Well, we're going to go into some very practical aspects. If you remember when we did the Primal Wound series, we had one of the episodes called Loving the Wounded, where we really went into, when you recognize what your partner's villain is, or your loved one, don't have to be partner, could be coworker, could be roommate, could be parent, child, whatever, like what are just more effective communication tools and conflict resolution, and I should say conflict prevention strategies to use with these different people. And I was talking to a friend who was having a problem with her husband, and she didn't know how to communicate with him because he's a nothing. And the communication she was using wasn't working. So she's like, I love your podcast, but like, I need some practical tips here. How do I talk to a nothing? So then that's what gave me the idea. Like, we should just have a whole communication episode. So that's kind of what we put together here. And then I thought I'll do the odds and you do the evens, and we'll just go in order and just talk about what communicating with these villains in an ideal situation would look like. And then obviously discuss our own experiences with them. Yeah. Okay. So the first one, as we know, is the obedient critic. And those people are very hyper rule following and perfectionists to a fault and very rigid about their thinking.
Yep.
And so the kind of problems that you might run into with them is they might be overcritical of you. They might easily take offense by things that you do that they don't agree with. They might think, like, when I was doing my internal family systems, like, I called this aspect of me the relationship cop, because she was like, well, if someone loves me, then they need to behave like this, this, and this. And if they don't, then they don't love me. Or if they don't, I need to whoop them into gear and put them in prison or whatever. You know, like, there's very rigid ideas of like what this behavior means. And it's really important for obedient critics to recognize that their rule set is not necessarily their partner's rule set. So if you're in a relationship with an obedient critic, it might be a really good idea one day to sit down and just be like, hey, like, what does the silent treatment mean to you? Like, or what does 24 hours of silence mean to you? And for them, they might be, oh, it means I'm busy and I'm focused on other things. And the obedient critic might think, well, to me, it's weaponized distance. You know, like, I'm making this up, but like, you should really just have conversations about what things mean to you. Like, for example, we have a friend, and if she wants to go to bed and her partner's not ready for bed, she's really mad because he needs to go to bed when she goes to bed. Whereas like me and my husband, we have different bedtimes, And we don't have that rule set of like, you need to sleep at the same time and with your partner, right? So anyways, these are just like ideas of like, okay, well, before the fight even begins, why not have a good conversation about rules? And also, like we talked about in one of our earlier episodes during the pandemic, how not to kill your partner in a pandemic, about making a relationship contract, which is really helpful in coming up with rules of like, what do we both agree on are fair rules of arguing? And one of those like that works for my marriage and Christina's marriage is, and Robbie, who taught us this, is like, you got, when an issue comes up, you have 24 hours to bring it up. It might not be resolved in those 24 hours, but you got to bring it up within 24 hours. And then you got to let everything before that go, right? Because it's not fair to hold on to stuff in the past and then keep bringing it up years and years later or months and months later when it's like, hey, have an iOS update, update the file. If your partner hasn't done it recently, don't bring it up, right? So these are good things. Do you want to add to any of that before I go into other communication stuff?
No, I think that's a really good way of saying it. And I think that that makes a lot of sense because the more that you understand your partner's rule set, if they are an obedient critic, the more you can recognize that. Because like when you step into their rule set, they're going to use language like, I don't feel valued, you know, self-worth things, or it's embarrassing, or all of like, these are the kind of languages you can tell that you've broken an obedient critic's rule set. And it's the triggers to you to be like, oh, they have an internalized rule set that they're not telling me. And what could that look like? So yeah, you were going to talk about more communication.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, here's a great example is I went to a social engagement and I invited a friend. And I'm at the party and I see them enter and I wave to them to come join me. Well, they got so upset that I didn't walk over to them and then walk into the party with them to introduce them. Whereas I was just standing on the sidelines waving for them to come to me. And they got really upset about it because in their world, like their rule set is, if you're not invited to the party directly and you're coming with someone, like you need to be escorted in and introduced in. And to me, I'm more casual and I'm just like, hey, come, I'm over here, come here. That wasn't like enough. And so it was, example, but it's exactly that. Like we both had two different rule sets. That person took a lot of offense to what I did. And in my world, like I would have been completely comfortable with arriving at a party and a friend waving me over. Right.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
It's just different values, different people. This is extremely important, I think, when you have people coming from different cultural backgrounds too, whether it be countries, religion, ethnicity, culture, whatever, like you really need to understand their rule set. If you haven't visited their other person's country and you're married to someone, you know, like my brother is married to a woman from China. He's been to China many times. He really understands her, I think, because he's willing to expose himself to the Chinese rule sets, right?
Yes, that's the ultimate expression. It's one of the ultimate expressions of the equalizer, the legend of this arc, is because of the fact that you recognize that your rule set isn't actually any better or worse than anybody else's. It's just different.
Exactly.
So whenever I hear somebody being like, I'm creating a boundary because you don't do this thing that I say is a requirement in a relationship, I would beg to say, how do you know that's the rule in the relationship? Have you ever tried a different rule set?
Yes.
Have you ever asked what their rule set is?
Yes.
Is there any way that you can take your rule set off of this thing of like, you have to adhere to it and find a different way of doing it? Because the more that you can compare your rule set to, especially an obedient critic's rule set, the more they can understand how things are important to you. And not get stuck right in this, like, this is how we always behave when people come over to the house sort of thing.
Where right. Like,
this is how my family behaved. Neither of them is better or worse. Can we decide between us to either create a new rule set or to honor the other person's reality?
Yeah. Rule set. And another thing you'll hear a lot from the obedient critics is, I would never do that. If I did that, it would mean blah, blah, blah. And you're like, yeah, but they're not you. Like you going 48 hours without calling your loved one, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, you would only do that if you hated them, right? But they might not do that. That might not be their rule set. Their rule set might be 72 hours is a normal time frame or whatever it is. I'm making it up. But when they say, if I did this, it would mean that. No, you, and then they interpret that behavior as meaning such and such a thing. It's just not fair. Anyways, talk about your rule sets as best as you can. And then Regarding the OC, if you have like a conflict with them, like if they're upset with you, one of the best things you can do is use permissive talk, not make demands, not be critical, and say, could we possibly do X, Y, and Z? You want to gently challenge them with permission. Like, I see what you want is perfect. Can I suggest something a little messy? Try to use things like maybe we could, like maybes, to kind of inch your way into their territory, because they're going to have very rigid rules about how things should be and that they should be perfect. And then again, if they're upset with you, just be like, I totally understand that you're upset with me, because in your world, this means this, but in my world, it doesn't mean that. Instead of saying, well, you're wrong, I didn't mean that. It's much better for you to say, I can totally see how in your world, it means that, and I honor your truth. But in my world, it means something a little differently. Can I show you what it means to me? Versus you're wrong. Like if you tell an obedient critic they're wrong, whew, you just threw like gasoline on the fire.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So for the obedient critic, as well as for the divisive immortal, you want to overshare information with them. That will also help prevent catastrophic disconnect.
Yes.
Because. All right. I'm done with OC, by the way, if you're ready for
I'll do the vibe.
Unless you have anything else to add for the.
No, that's great.
Okay.
That's great.
Okay.
So the vengeful martyr. The vengeful martyr, since they're all about energy, and since one of the main ways that they can show up is as the banker, one of the things that one of the languages that you're going to hear from a vengeful martyr, if they're a partner, is talking about how tired they are, how much they've done, how much they think they deserve rest, which is the apologetic. That's one of the covert forms of this person. So if you have a partner who is asking for permission, your permission to be able to rest, that's very vengeful martyr. One of the things that you'll also notice is that in the language of a vengeful martyr, they are tallying very likely all the things that they have done in a day. So if you want to be able to connect with your vengeful martyr partner or friend, you know, one of the things you can do is you can ask them and you can be curious and be like, hey, what did you do today for the family, or something along those lines? Not in an accusatory way, just like curious, like tell me all the brilliant things that you did that I know that you were just like, did so well. You were so streamlined. You were so efficient. Like you used your energy so well, being curious to try and connect with them at all the ways that they have fulfilled what they feel is their actions that they've completed and the energy that they've given towards caretaking and the energy that they've given towards helping other people. That's a really good way of being able to connect with them. If you really want to connect with them further, recognize that continually giving them not just, you know, it seems silly to give them permission to rest, but permission to rest when you're partners with a vengeful martyr extends well beyond just being like, you should go rest, because it also has to do with being competent enough to not necessarily replace them, but to be able to communicate with them what you are going to do, be able to ask, what can I do better? Like sometimes, you know, I mean, you can say how you feel about this, but I'll give an example of, you know, my husband does, or used to do a lot of the cooking, and he still does a lot, but, you know, and I'm just like, what is going to be the most helpful thing for you so that you feel like you can rest and not have to worry about anything? Right. And how about every single time you're resting and all these things come up, you just text me. You text me all the new things that need to happen, or something along those lines. What do you think about that, Anna? What would you add or take away?
Well, I was going to just add to this, like, if you have small children, if the vengeful martyr in your life is the primary caregiver of small children, the best thing you can do is to take those kids out of the house, right? Like you want to take away the things that give them the most sense of responsibility. You want to take them away from that. Like I have a friend who runs a little vengeful martyr, and every now and then her husband sends her to a hotel. And she just needs to be away from the house, because that's her source of responsibility, right? So not everyone can afford that, I understand. But like, if you can in any way take away the thing that they feel responsible for, like take it on completely or separate them completely from that situation, even better, like let's say your husband didn't want to go for a walk. Maybe, you know, Luke didn't want to go for a rest. Maybe you could tell him like, hey, go for a walk. I got the house or whatever, you know, whatever it is. Cause he's the primary help, you know, homemaker. So to send him away.
Yes. Yes. And I think that the thing that you can basically always assume with a vengeful martyr is that you have a deficit to them somehow. So find their language of love. Some people may just like really also find that there's value in acts of gratitude, right? Or words of, you know, words of affirmation. That's what I was thinking of, you know, words of affirmation being like, thank you so much, things like that. I would agree with you that words don't mean shit if you don't have the service to back it up. So it's that's what I was saying in terms of being like, hey, why don't you go rest? And then not being competent enough so that it's even worse once they do rest and then they come back. It's like there's so many vengeful martyrs at work. Work vengeful martyrs are the ones that never take vacation because they know that if they go on vacation, no one is going to be able to do their job for them. And they're just going to have so much work to pick up when they come back that they just never rest as a result of it. Right. And that's where it's like knowing that you have that person in your life, you have to become very good at the things that they are, or at least develop a basic competency so that they feel that they can rest.
Exactly. Because saying go ahead and rest, but they know that when they are done resting, they have more work to do isn't truly rest. And, right. You know,
right.
So, being very competent.
Being very competent. But it's like, because, you know, there's an acknowledgement here of the fact that vengeful martyrs are very enabling of this behavior in which nobody else has competence but them. That's part of their strategy. So you have to insert yourself to develop competencies or to understand what they consider competency, which is sometimes more important because they may have their own rule set for what competency is. You know, like you have to do that in order to be able to insert yourself and to stop the enabling behavior that a vengeful martyr will have to make it so that everybody else in their life is incompetent and they're the only ones that can rescue everyone.
Right. And so I just have in my notes that you, when you're in a relationship with these people, do not take advantage of their willingness to take on excessive responsibility. Insist on taking ownership of problems or messes or contributing it in your own way. Like we were talking last episode, my family, my marriage is a very divide and conquer marriage, right? Like we, in our house, we do the things that we either want to do, we like to do, or we're good at doing. And then the other person, luckily the other person is like, it feels that way about the opposite things, right? But I think it's really important to maybe take on more of what you're good at if you see them overwork, you know, doing too much of something else. But this is all preventative. What would you say when the vengeful martyr is now in that, you know, hyper overexhausted state and very upset and angry? Like what's a good way to communicate with them then?
I would say the good way to communicate with them is to somehow cut them off from responsibility by getting them to down. I mean, it's how would you communicate with them? Knowing that they're in a vengeful state, I think that one of the most important things when someone's in a vengeful state as a vengeful martyr is just to be like, I hear you, I'm listening. Like take notes and just like accept that they are going to be raging and know that this is probably cyclical. This is probably not the first time, right? So you like, you know, we talked in the past about Anna, how you had it every month. You had that vengeful part come out and to be like, what is the best thing that I can do for this person right now to just still love them despite their vengeance? And then next month, we're going to do better at not letting them overservice everyone else around them so that this becomes less.
Right. I'd say there's some magic words. I'd say, I'm so sorry I hurt your feelings. Like whether or not you mean it or think you have a role in it, I think that just helps put out the fire and you can deal with the reality when they're calm of whose fault it really is. But I would say, you know, I'm so sorry I hurt your feelings. And I want to say, well, just tell me what you need or tell me what you want me to do. Well, they might be like, well, look around. Isn't it obvious? So that might not help. I know for me, when I was a vengeful martyr, being hugged helped. I don't know if that's true for everyone. Making me laugh helped. I don't know if that's true for everyone. I don't know.
Yeah, it's really hard because a lot of this is preventative stuff because guess what? You want to buy dinner for everyone, but then you have to ask your partner what everybody wants to eat because you don't know what your kids like to eat.
Yeah. That's, and you want them to order.
That's problematic.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. That you want them to matter because, to order because you just don't know. All right. Vein controller.
Okay. Go ahead. Do you want to give the summary of the vein controller? I feel like you're faster at that than me.
The vein controller is all about trying to appear like they have everything under control. They are going to be super concerned with how their outward appearance is. So it's different than rule sets. They are very concerned with the status of looking like they are hardworking and that they have everything under control, that they are ultimately successful. And they struggle with trust a lot. And they struggle with being vulnerable a lot.
All right. So what I have in my notes is, with these people, you really want to avoid competitions with them. You want to embrace their flaws. Anytime that they show any sign of vulnerability or flaws, you really want to be conscientious of, like, not making jokes about it, not bringing it up later in an argument, just really embracing that, the beauty of their, of them showing you their flaws or sharing something that it makes them not look so great. Right. You want to set an example for humility and vulnerability. Like, it's a lot easier maybe for them to share something uncomfortable if you start first, like, hey, I did this, you know, I made a fool of myself at work today, I did this, or, you know, just be really transparent and honest about your own flaws. That might help them open up more. When they get to that point of, as my husband calls it, getting to the big top.
Hitting the big top. Yeah, yeah.
Hitting the big top is what he calls it. And I think he has some vein controller. Gosh, what is the best way? I don't know if I found it.
Okay, so the thing is with the vein controller, they're the persecutor form. So they're likely going to be attacking and not defensive, right? They're going to be very aggressive. So one of the best things I find to do is to get it so that they can feel rewarded, because there's a lot about reward in this, because they think that their hard work needs to be rewarded. And so the more that you can reward them with something, especially if it's something that looks like status, you're going to be able to diffuse the vein controller a lot more. Reminding that this is the betrayal wound. So one of the really, really key things with vein controllers is you keep your promises that you make, right? Like, if you don't keep your promises, you're going to hit that vein controller is going to lose their mind. So especially if you're just like, oh my gosh, you work so hard. I love how you work so hard. I promised you that I was going to take you out to coffee as a result of you working so hard. And we're going to go to the best coffee spot and whatever, the best restaurant and whatever. Like, you got to do that. And you got to follow through with it. Because a vein controller, absolutely, they expect the promises to be kept. They do not want to be betrayed. And if they hit that critical, if they get totally bent out of shape, they are going to go on the attack.
Right. So we only have preventative stuff for the vein controller. You don't really.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's a good thing to recognize too, is that once you break the trust of the vein controller, it can be exceptionally hard to regain that trust. And so the communication and the language that you have with them says, I realize that I broke this promise with you. I'm sorry that I broke this promise. Here's what I'm going to do to work harder. So using lots of terminology like, I broke a promise, I recognize I did this, I'm sorry that I betrayed you, I am going to work harder, because they are hard workers, I am going to work harder to be able to make sure that I do not break these types of promises with you in the future, and this is how I'm going to do it, right?
Sounds great. All right, eternal child, Christina.
Okay, eternal children are, if we think of them as children, we think of that in many, many ways. They are ultimately looking for love, protection, guidance, nurturance, right? Nourishment. And so when you speak to an eternal child, or when an eternal child gets bent out of shape, they can often go into confabulation world, right? So they're just kind of like creating stories all over the place about what happened, about how they're the victim, about all these different things. So when they get in that really bad space in conflict, they are going to be creating a reality that you may not recognize. And so ultimately, when they use terms that are very victim-centered. Again, when it feels like they're lying, when it feels like they are being very dramatic and exaggerating, those are the kind of indications that the eternal child has kind of met a point of conflict. In normal conversation, they may speak a lot about being entitled or deserving of something. Like, hey, I deserve this, I deserve that. But it's very different than a vain controller in the sense that they may not have worked hard in order to earn that, and you may be aware of that. And so when they reach that point of like ultimate bent out of shape, your job is to nourish them and say, and to kind of get into that space where you're just like, I'm going to take care of you. Like language that talks about, I'm going to take care of you. Right. So it's very similar. It's kind of like the flip coin of the vengeful martyr, but you know, one that says like, you know, one of two things, either I'm going to take care of you, or I have so much belief that you can take care of this. I trust that you can take care of this on your own, but I am here for support 100% of the way, right? So it's like, instead of taking care of them, you're pushing them out of the nest. I think you can fly, but I'm here to support you 100% of the way.
Right. That's when they go in their victim rants. Mm-hmm. To prevent it, what are some tools? Like you told me to have clear communication with consequences.
Yes, that's the really important thing, because it is a child. You have to give them consequences, and you have to make those consequences appropriate for the crime, so to speak, or for whatever it is, and you're consistent with it. I once read, do you remember that Bébé book, the French parenting book? Did you ever read that back when we were like—
Yeah, Bringing Up Bébé.
Bringing Up Bébé. Like they were literally like the one thing that French parents are consistent. And I was like, they're like, if you can do anything as a parent, it's be consistent. And that is ultimately what you see with all of these, you'll see that they're similar to the ones around them, but being consistent with the way that you say things and being consistent with the consequences of what happens, and not kind of being indulgent and being like, oh, it's so hard to say it because I'm using it in a child context. But if you have a partner who wants to go out every Friday to watch a movie because they think they deserve it, but you know, this week actually you've gone out to the movie three other times before, you're going to be like, we're not going to do that this time, because we really want to be able to earn that, right? Like we really want to be able to earn the like ability to go out to the movies. And so it's like you're trying to keep up a consistency of reward and entitlement as much as possible as their partner, which just feels like parenting, but it is kind of parenting for an eternal child.
Yeah. I personally find relating to the eternal children very difficult because they are so delusional. I feel like all the other villains, there's avenues in because they're grounded in reality, but this one, it's like, you can't tell an eternal child they're an eternal child. You know, they're going to take it worse than anyone else. They're very much caught up in their stories, their little narratives and their stories. And that's exhausting.
You can give them evidence. You can give them evidence.
But it doesn't even work.
True. Yeah.
I have here in my notes, when they're doing something unrealistic, you could say, hey, I love your dream side. Also, we need to think a little practical about X, Y, and Z, right? Like they're kind of going to want to be delusional about things, saying things like, I love that you're seeing it this way, but let's look at it this way also. And just kind of bring in more practicalities.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
I think that eternal children do have what I would call a tantrum, right? Like they're scary when they have their tantrums, basically, like when they don't get what they want, just like a child, they will have this outburst. That's very entitled outburst, different than the RB, when the righteous bully attacks you, or the vengeful martyr attacks you, or the obedient critic criticizes you. And like, it's very different. It's kind of like totally controlless. There's no control. Like you don't know what they're going to do. Are they going to crash your car? Are they going to break your things? Like you just don't know. It's very immature. So when they get to that point, I don't know how you would diffuse. I've never really been on that end of it. I just have heard about it. But what would you say you could do when eternal child's having a tantrum?
You have to give them age appropriate consequences. You really do. Because otherwise they're just going to keep doing it over and over and over again. Right. So it's like, you know, if they're a 36-year-old eternal child or a 42-year-old eternal child, and they have consistently acted out in a harmful manner to you, and yet you're constantly enabling them to continue on that without actually giving them any consequences for it, like they're never going to be in a space of growth. And so it's ultimately, and sometimes and oftentimes that means cutting them off, because until they're willing to give up their stance as the victim, you are always going to be the persecutor or the rescuer.
Right. So next week, we'll wrap it up and we'll start with the Evasic Expert and continue through the rest. We hope so far you've learned a lot, and we look forward to sharing more about communicating with these villains.
Thanks, y'all.
Thanks. Bye.
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 Thank you so much for listening to this episode of This Spiritual Fix. If you are interested in finding out what your primary inner villain is, you can go to www.christinawiltse.com to take the test that is linked. That's KristinaWiltse.com. Thanks, y'all.
And remember,
humility, gratitude, acceptance, done.
Hi y'all, Christina from TSF here, This Spiritual Fix. I wanted to invite you to my Substack, where we are about to start a series on the inner villains, the parts of us that sabotage, control, or quietly hide when things get hard. These upcoming posts will walk you through how to recognize them, work with them, and eventually transform them. They're going to be a wonderful complement to what we're hearing here on TSF. And if you are a paid subscriber, you'll also get a new meditation each month to support that integration. You can find it all at ChristinaWiltse.substack.com or search The Life Alchemist. Thanks, y'all.